Hey there, this is Jen Schaefer and this is Crudax. We are actually interrupting another series that I'm working on to embark on this series that I'm going to start right now. And I know it's kind of crazy and wonky and it's out of order and out of the way you should do things, but there's a little bit of urgency to this. So I want to get this going right away. When I first decided to do this podcast, I actually really just wanted to do one case, like one case in particular. I didn't want to do a bunch of episodes and a bunch of different ones. And this case is one that's been in my brain for decades. We're talking 30 plus years, ever since 1988, when an episode of the television show A Current Affair aired on TV. So the episode was about the 1985 murder of two Baytown women named Debbie Merritt and Sandy Terrell. It featured my father, who was one of the lead detectives on the case. The show delved into the surface level of the case, really just perpetuating local rumors that the victims were lured into a lifestyle of sex and drugs and the pursuit of the high life. It was titled Hunt and Chase, based on the biggest rumor of the story, that the women became involved in an ongoing kinky sex game that was of the same name, and that is what got them killed. So I watched this as a kid. It leaves an impression. Years pass, right? Fast forward to now. And that case still remains unsolved and has been tucked away. Like many cold cases, it's been forgotten. Well, I never forgot this case. It buried itself into my brain all those years ago and has existed there for a very long time. And when I decided that I wanted to do this case as a podcast series, I knew that I had to get my father involved in it. He, along with Texas Ranger David Maxwell, were the lead detectives on the case from 1987 to 1992. Reluctantly, I brought him the idea. At first, he was very disinterested. He encouraged me to do other cases instead, solved cases, cases with closure, and I did some of those cases. But I had it in my mind. I had my heart set on this particular case. And so I just did some soft research at first. And I brought him what I found out just searching on the internet. I even found family members on Facebook of one of the victims. And when I brought this to him, it actually piqued his interest. And so from there, we were off to the races. Never imagining all the things that we'd come to discover, things that he didn't even know back then. My dad started making calls and having conversations with other retired officers. We both met with the family members of the victims. He took the boots on the ground method, which is, you know, the old school ways. And I also began my research. I became practically connected to my computer all day, all night, rummaging through everything from obituaries to open corporates to newspaper articles to yearbook photos, you name it. And from that research, connections began to form. A sturdy, expansive web of connections that grew more and more each day. I had to keep it all organized, so I began to write and write, and the story grew and grew, and to this day, I still haven't stopped writing. As it sits now, I've written about 75,000 words, and it is still incomplete. Because we hit a huge snag. So the snag was local law enforcement refused to cooperate with us. They wouldn't hear us out. They even declared my dad as a liar with the things that he brought to them. I wanted to know why. It didn't make sense. My dad especially wanted to know why. I mean, these are men that he worked with and that he respected and he thought respected him. None of it really made any sense. But come to find out, this cold murder case is just a dangling thread of a much bigger tale. A Southern American tale, steeped in money, power, drugs, corruption, influential families, and the cops, who protected them then and continue to protect them now. Upon discovering that, that is when I became entrapped, ensnared in the web myself. I became part of the story, not just the storyteller. And this became personal to both me and my father. And this is the burden that we've been carrying since 2021. To bring it all full circle, I decided just a few days ago, 2023, that maybe what I should do is go back to the beginning, take a step back, remember my reason for doing all this in the first place, a podcast, a story to tell you all, free from all the red tape. Doing it that way, I can tell you the story exactly the way I want to tell it. It's a set of scissors I can use to cut myself free from the red tape and free from the tangled web, free to tell you a story about a murder and all the things buried with it. Horror writer James Herbert once wrote, "To be haunted is to glimpse a truth that might best be hidden." This case, this story, is not just about the murder of two women. It's about why the murders happened in the first place, where and when the murders took place, and why they have yet to be solved, why they may never be solved. This case is about secrets, buried secrets, damning secrets. And the thing I know about secrets is they tend to haunt the people who buried them. But I have news for them. The ghosts are going to be set free, and they will no longer be hidden, and I plan to stream them out episode by episode, all in order to find justice for the two women, Deborah Merritt, Sandy Terrell. And I have to do it the only way I know how, and that's with a story. So without further ado, let's just get this thing going. I'm Jen Schaefer, and this is Crudax Murder in an Oil Town. Who killed Debbie and Sandy? Episode 1, Where Young Girls' Dreams Go Up in Smoke. So what I'm going to do first and foremost is I'm going to dive into the case. It's going to be something that you could probably read elsewhere. It's the bare bones, the bare knuckles, what happened, and it's going to lead us to the point where we pick it up and start investigating. So here we go. This is the first episode. It was an early evening, November 15th, 1985, Baytown, Texas. 35-year-old Sandra Terrell, they call her Sandy, was all packed up for what was going to be a fun-filled trip to Los Angeles, California. She packed up just enough clothes for the weekend, two pairs of jeans, two blouses, one dress and one red dress, lingerie, and her toiletries. It was going to be a short trip, but it was going to be one she desperately needed. She was a newly divorced woman with two teen kids, and she worked two jobs, so she earned herself a break. The trip to LA was lined up by one of her best friends, Debbie Merritt. They were to attend the grand opening of a new hotel slash nightclub owned by a wealthy pilot friend of Debbie's named Bob. At around 7 p.m., the two women loaded up their suitcases in Debbie's 1982 silver Datsun, and they headed out to Hobby Airport in Houston for their fun-filled weekend. The weekend flashed by the way that weekends tend to do, and Sunday rolls around, and the two women never returned. Sandy's family immediately reported their disappearance to Baytown police, and in their typical fashion, they told them they needed to wait 72 hours to file an official missing persons report. So they waited the allotted time, and then they returned to the department to officially file the report, and they did, but still, police didn't take them seriously. They even told the family members the two women more than likely just took off for a better life and left them all behind. They didn't put much effort into the investigation, just the basics. They checked out flights going out of Hobby to LA and found out the two women never showed up at the airport. It was as if they drove off together and just kept on driving, like Thelma and Louise did. The police told the family just to wait it out, that the two women will eventually run out of money and will more than likely return home after that. So, again, they waited. They waited. Days passed, weeks, months, and not a word was heard from the two women. So the family decided they would take things into their own hands. They attended a city council meeting, and while they were there, they requested that my father, Detective Paul Schaefer, was to be put on the case. He had been a part of a team that was successful in solving the murder of a young girl who was murdered in a nearby apartment complex. That happened that same year. The families of the missing women were impressed by his dedication and the attention that he gave the case, so they requested him. And my dad, he took the case. So he was to work alongside Texas Ranger David Maxwell, who was assigned by Baytown Police Chief Hensey. So David Maxwell comes from Austin out to Baytown, sets up an office, and he and my dad got their investigation underway. Frances Strickland, Sandy's mother, and Candy Crawford, Sandy's identical twin sister, launched their own private investigation. They handed out hundreds of flyers all around town and made hundreds of calls desperately searching for them. They even went so far as to hiring a psychic out in California who gave them a dismal prediction that both women were dead. Their bodies were in swamplands not far from their hometown. To hear that was devastating, but it was not enough to stop their search. They pressed on. Twin sister Candy hit up all the bars around Baytown, places that she knew her sister and her friend Debbie hung out at. She collected as much information as she possibly could, writing down all the names and places in a small black notebook. One day, she started receiving unnerving anonymous phone calls, saying things like her sister was dead and they knew where the body was. On one of the calls, an unrecognizable male gave her a threat. "Your sister is dead, and you'll end up the same way if you don't stop going around and asking so many questions." She informed the detectives immediately that this was going on, and they tapped her phones to trace the calls. But during that time, the calls stopped. They waited for a few weeks, nothing. Eventually, due to cost, they had to pull the plug. But right after that, the calls resumed. The threats resumed. Candy was becoming scared for her life. That fear was realized weeks later when the threats became real. Candy on her way out of her apartment door one day, before she could even take a step out, she noticed there on her welcome mat was a coiled up snake. She quickly slammed the door and hid inside and phoned the police. When they showed up, they ran up the apartment steps to the door and they realized the snake was actually dead. They checked the perimeter. There was no one around. There was no note. But this proves that the threats were getting serious and something bad could really happen. Katie decided it was time for her to lay low from the investigation. So she turned her little black book of notes and names over to Assistant Police Chief Bob Dabney. And after doing that, it was never seen again. In June 1986, 7 months after Debbie and Sandy went missing, there was finally a break in the case. Debbie's car, that 1982 Silver Datsun, was found in an apartment complex in Pasadena, Texas, about 20 miles west of Baytown, right off the route that one would take going to Hobby Airport from Quail Hollow Apartments. After a thorough inspection of the car, police discovered it had been recently wiped clean, like deep cleaned. It was completely devoid of any fingerprints or any blood or anything. The belongings were missing too. Also missing was a tire from the car, which was unusual. The manager of the complex told the investigators that the car had only been parked there for a few weeks and he had never seen anyone fitting the descriptions of the women. Again, it seems like the two of them simply vanished. The year 1986 comes to an end with no sign of Debbie or Sandy. The family at this point was starting to worry and wonder if they'd ever see them again, and the police were starting to lose steam with their search. At this point, there were only loose leads, and those leads provided very little information. They were all living in limbo on little sleep and food. They were hounded by the feelings of helplessness while trying to stay immersed in the feelings of hope. The flyers posted on buildings and windows became torn and faded, along with the interest from the community that was beginning to slowly move on. That is, until everything came to a grinding halt on March 26th, 1987. Dad said he was packing up his boxes at Baytown PD, and he got a call while he was doing so from the Chambers County Sheriff's Department. The reason he was packing his boxes is that he was actually leaving his job at Baytown, and he accepted a promotion at Chambers County, and so he's on his way to doing that. And so he's there, he gets the call, and the call is some big news. A man mending fences at the end of a shell road in Winnie, Texas, which is a small town about 40 miles east of Baytown, found two badly decomposed bodies in a dried out marshland. Dad said he dropped everything and he rushed out to the scene. And when he got there, his fellow policemen were excavating the bones. Straight away, they could tell by the clothing items that the bodies were more than likely those of the victims. They then found, after digging some more, their purses, jewelry, money, and luggage in a pile next to them. It was later confirmed by the medical examiner that the remains were indeed that of Sandy Terrell and Debbie Merritt. Sadly, the California psychic was right. Debbie and Sandy had been out there in a swampy marsh all along, just like she said. I asked my father if they could tell how the women died, and he stated it was assumed that Sandy was shot to death twice on her side and another in the back, and that she died almost instantly. Debbie, on the other hand, may have been tortured and repeatedly stabbed to death. There were rips in her blouse and deeply set blood stains that indicated she was possibly stabbed multiple times with a knife that hooked on the end. The autopsies, though, ruled their cause of death as a homicide, with a manner of death as undetermined. It was then that the missing persons case finally came to a close. And then this case became a homicide case. Investigators, including my father, had to go back to all their leads from the very beginning and start interviewing them in a new capacity. Naturally, they started with the ex-husbands, which makes the most sense because, especially regarding Deborah Merritt and how she seems to have died, I mean, dozens of stab wounds, that sounds like a crime of passion, right? Sandy was newly separated from her husband, and if her husband discovered that she was seeing someone and he blamed Debbie for that, he could have killed them both out of anger and jealousy. What if Debbie's husband did it out of jealousy, out of rage, out of not having control of her anymore? Police interviewed them. Nothing came out of it. Their alibis checked out, and they asked them and every family member to take a polygraph test, in which they did. They all passed, and they all were ruled out. Weeks turns to months and months stacked to years. The deeper detectives dug into the case, the more difficult everything became, including cooperation from informants. There was a lot of misinformation to sort through and a lot of dead ends. Gossip began to spread all over town that the reason that this happened was because the women wanted to be jet setters and got caught up in the underbelly of the nightlife. My dad was interviewed on A Current Affair, like I told you guys in the beginning. And of course, that program perpetuated all of those rumors. I didn't really talk about what the show was in the beginning of this episode, but I'd like to talk about, for our young listeners at least, what the TV show A Current Affair is. So back in the late 1900s, we didn't have the ID Network, the Oxygen Channel, all these true crime podcasts and all the shows. We didn't have YouTube and we didn't have cold case files. What we did have was A Current Affair. It was a TV news series that ran from 1986 to 1996, and they were one of the few programs out there that actually covered true crime as we know it now. I remember when my dad said he was going to be on the show, we were all excited. Being on TV was a big deal back then. And when it aired, we all huddled around the television to watch it because that's what you had to do back in the olden days. And you had to watch it that night or record it on your VCR if you ever wanted to watch it again. Side note, we did record it back then. And it was on a VHS tape. My dog Ginger got a hold of it and had her way with it and tore it to shreds. So I don't know, I guess she wasn't a fan of the show, but the tape is gone forever. I've been searching archives. Hopefully one day, if they could even help me out, I can find that so I can watch that again and then also share with you guys. The episode, though, I do remember it vividly. Like I said, it's the thing that planted the seed in my brain, the thing that would haunt my brain for decades. So what it portrayed is all of the mystery, right? And all the unanswered questions and what the show was, you know, pretty disturbing for a young girl. The murders were incredibly brutal. The families were so deeply impacted. And this all happened in my hometown, Baytown, Texas. And I was just a kid and a young girl, to be exact. And I say that because the opening dialogue to the episode was something like this, and I can still hear it in Steve Dunleavy's distinct Australian accent, and pardon me while I butcher it, but this is what he said. Welcome to Baytown, boring, honest Baytown, a boomtown gone bust where young girls' dreams go up in smoke. Those words stuck. They became an ever-present echo on loop in my brain, leading me to view Baytown as some ominous place that existed and perhaps even thrived on the consumption of young girls' dreams. Baytown at once became a dark place, a trap from which I wondered if I'd ever escape. Would I, could I end up like the two women in the story? Could I one day disappear, be snatched from the earth, only to be found years later in some swampy vortex? Would I become a case for someone else to solve? Well, I promise if that were to ever happen, I would come back as a ghost and even haunt the great-grandchildren of my killers, and I would have my revenge, but I was 12 years old. So then they talked about the brutality of the case. It scares me. I'm thinking all these things. And then they started to talk about the kinky sex game, the hunt and chase game. So that game went something like this. The goal of the women playing this game was to hunt down a pot of money that was hidden by the men playing the game. And then the goal of the men was to hunt the women as they looked for the money. They were all given a map and a list of places to go as well as clues. And now if the women were to find the money before they got caught, they got to keep the money. But if the men found the women before they found the money, they had to be their sex slaves for the weekend. The game, of course, was always rigged in favor of the men. The show, just like the rumors, claimed in the case of Debbie and Sandy that this is what happened, this is what they were involved in, things went awry during the game, and the women lost their lives. They knew that the lascivious tale had everything that viewers would want to salivate over: murder, sex, money. And honestly, they were right. The same tales were told to peddle newspapers later on, and it kept up interest in the case. And when it came to helping solve the case, though, it didn't help. All that it really achieved was successfully dragging Debbie and Sandy's name through the mud. And we all know what happens to cases of scarlet-lettered women. Those cases go unsolved. And that's exactly what happened to them. So, with no answers, no follow-up, and in the mid-1990s, all was forgotten. They thought it would be forgotten, because it has been for so long. But here's the thing. I never forgot this case. Not a year would go by without me thinking of it at least once. I'd even asked my dad about it here and there throughout the years, and he told me, without going into specifics, they were maybe close to finding out who did it, but he just couldn't close the deal, and that was just that. That was just that was the mantra for a very long time. That was just that is what compelled me to tell this story in the first place. And now that you, listeners, have an idea of the bare bones of the case, in our next episode, we're going to dive into the investigation. I'm going to take you down the long, winding road of discovery, something how it started off back then. And then we'll ease into what we discovered now. Get out your shovels, because it is a lot of digging. And we are going to start that excavation in our next episode. So stay tuned for that. And for now, this is Crudax Murder in Old Town, Who Killed Debbie and Sandy. I'm Jen Schaefer. I'm the researcher, writer, and voice that you hear. Russell Dunlap helps produce this thing and makes it pretty, and Amy Dunlap manages me and keeps me on track. The intro music is by Two Star Symphony, my talented friends and fellow Houstonians. You can check them out on the web and hear them on streaming services. I believe they have some shows coming up as well if you're in the Houston area. Our next episode will be out soon. I'm wanting to book this thing out, so be on the lookout for that. For supplemental reading, you can check out www.crudax.com, and you can find us on the socials. If you feel compelled to subscribe, we have an option for that on our website. Click and contribute. Contributions will help get these episodes out even faster. I'm very excited to bring you this series. This is something that I have been working on for several years, and though we are far from finished, I still have a lot tied up in a little bow that I would like to untie and share with you. And I hope that you are just as excited to hear about it as I am to tell it. It means a lot to us, and it means a lot to the families. So thank you very much, and we will see you next time.